This is The Political Animals, conversations at the intersection of religion, politics, and culture. I'm your host, Jonathan Cole, and in this episode, I talk to Dr. Simon Kennedy about Pete Viereck and new conservatism. Simon, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again, Jonathan. It's good to be here.
Who is Simon Kennedy?
The mysterious Simon. I'm the associate editor of Quadrant magazine. You can go to quadrant.org.au and you can access the content and the magazine on there. It's an Australian-based conservative right-wing monthly magazine that has daily content online. We publish essays on all kinds of issues around politics, ideas, culture, the arts, poetry. There's poetry, there's short stories. There's a range of really interesting content that we publish. That it's quite a unique venue actually in Australia. And yeah, I'm really happy to be a part of what's happening at Quadrant. I also am a honorary senior research fellow at the law school at the University of Queensland. I'm not a lawyer. I vehemently deny being a lawyer, but I am a historian and I work on the history of law, the history of political thought, and the history of Christianity and the intersections between those. So I have, you know, an interest in those areas, as well as have done some work in modern Australian constitutional history as well. Just a little bit of that. So there's that side, as well as being a think tank person. So I'm a fellow at the Danube Institute, which is in Budapest. I'm not in residence there, obviously. I'm based in Queensland in Australia, but they're my hats that I wear.
You're covering three fields. You're in media, the think tank world, and academia.
That's right.
It's not bad.
It's a fun life, actually. It's good.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm in two of them, academia and media.
Yeah.
Just not in the think tank. I guess that's how intellectuals make their living these days, Simon.
That's right.
I should say how they eke out their existence.
Yes.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned poetry, because although poetry is not the subject of this conversation, we are looking at a poet by the name of Peter Viereck, and he was a conservative intellectual in the 20th century. He was born in New York in 1916 and lived to the ripe old age of 90. He died in 2006. He studied at both Harvard and Oxford. And really, he was a professional academic for his whole career. He was professor of history at Mount Holyoke College. And not only was he a poet, but he won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry in 1949. And what's interesting about Viereck, I think, Simon, is this is from the age where conservatives had elite education at Ivy League institutions, worked as academics. And you mentioned Quadrant magazine, which has been publishing poetry really since its founding editor, who was a poet too. I think that was Donald Horne, wasn't it? No, he was the second. It was Macaulay was the first one. And right. Although we'll tackle this, or I'll tackle it maybe with a poet or someone who knows something about poetry, which is more than I know zero. But I don't know what it is with conservative intellectuals and poetry. This is the beloved art form of the conservative intellectual, it seems. But what we are going to look at more closely is actually an essay that Peter Viereck wrote that was published in his collection of essays called Conservatism Revisited, The Revolt Against Ideology, and that was published in 1949. But this particular essay, which is fascinating, is called The New Conservatism, What Went Wrong? And there's a lot in this essay, but I want to begin with this key concept of new conservatism. And this is really fascinating, and I'd love to know what you thought about this, Simon, because Viereck began arguing for what he called a Burkean new conservatism in America all the way back in the 1930s, which is a couple of decades before the so-called conservative movement begins in the US in the early to mid-50s. It's before World War II, which is fascinating. And Viereck's father, who was German, was actually a Nazi sympathizer, and I think he was arrested during World War II. Simon, what is this new conservatism and what do you make of it?
Viereck, just to begin with, I will answer your question directly in a second, but I wanted to say that this is such an interesting essay to talk about and to read because it sits outside, really, it sits outside the kind of mainstream conservative discourse that I'm used to engaging with. So I'm actually really pleased that we're talking about this today. And this idea of a new conservatism was very interesting. Although, in a sense, there were some aspects to this new conservatism that weren't so surprising to me, others that were. The thing that wasn't too surprising was that he describes it as basically conservative liberalism. I think that's one aspect where he's pro the Lockean Whig roots of the conservative way of thinking about politics and culture. And by that, he basically is going back to the 1688 Glorious Revolution. He's going back to people like Burke, who was himself a member of the Whig Party. And he's saying that these liberal, classical liberal values, and even someone like Mill expresses these values as well, he says, are good. And these are part of America's conservative foundations. So that's the first aspect of it. The second, and that's perhaps not too surprising because, I mean, I think you would agree, Jonathan, there's something about that aspect before we move on to the other aspects that's actually pretty well coherent with what we see in American Republican conservatism today. Is that fair?
Yeah, yeah. Although I suppose the difference is that few conservatives in the US today, I think, would embrace the notion that the actual conservative tradition in the US is a liberal conservative synthesis. Although that's possibly partly, well, put it this way, I did find myself wondering exactly what Viereck meant by liberalism
so
in the 1930s, because there is this progressivism movement, I think, in the 1920s in the US, and all the way up until about the 60s, you've got your Hayeks and Friedmans calling themselves liberals. So I don't know exactly when the term liberal in the US comes to mean what we would probably call progressive here in Australia. And so I guess from what you're saying, and I think this was my interpretation, he's really talking about what we would might call a classical liberalism, so that the, you know, individual rights, freedoms, perhaps free enterprise matched with that kind of Burkean focus on the little platoons and the sort of we'll get on to this notion of archetypes, the kind of timeless principles that transcend time and space versus the ephemeral. And he was a critic of abstract ideas. So I think you could argue, Simon, which I think you're arguing, and I am agreeing with you, that the synthesis he sees you can still see in American conservatism. But when I saw this notion that and actually let me see if I can find a quote. No, I'll let you get back to answering the question. I've now taken over. But he says this. He talks about actually what he calls America's political paradox. He says, our conservatism, in the absence of medieval feudal relics, must grudgingly admit it has little real tradition to conserve except that of liberalism, which then turns out to be a relatively conservative liberalism. So tell me what you think, but I think the way he's naming this synthesis is kind of anathema politically, rhetorically in America today, isn't it? Because it's all liberalism versus conservatism.
Yeah, and this is partly a rhetorical confusion. I don't think it's so much a theoretical confusion, because I think a lot of the things that come through classical liberalism are emphasized by particularly American and I would say Australian conservatives today, which is the list of things that you've just named. Which all come under the banner of liberty, I guess, free markets, free individuals, free societies. And so I believe when he's talking about liberal, we should be thinking of something more like British, like 19th century British liberalism, which was not inherently progressive and it had progressive elements, but it's not Rawlsianism. It's not John Rawls. It's not the Rawlsian liberal tradition that was post 1960s, that was pro civil rights movement and so on and so forth. But it's recalling a much earlier tradition, and I think that this rhetoric comes from a pre-war milieu. So there's some confusion there, I think. Although I think American historians, political historians, would have a bit more nuance to add to this conversation. But this is what I'm sensing as we're reading this. The other thing that I think was really interesting to come to your question about what else about is this new conservatism is he embraces the New Deal. Now, the New Deal was Franklin Roosevelt's quite significant expansion of the administrative state that also was an expansion of the welfare state in the United States. Virick, very interestingly to me, argues that this is conservative. And he comes back to this rhetorically in a number of fascinating ways, which he kept going on about it. And I found this so surprising, because I was thinking, if anyone was to argue this today and call themselves a conservative, they'd be lambasted for saying the New Deal is conservative. But he's writing, again, I think it's a symptom of the time that he's writing. And he's saying this is a conservative thing to do. And he recalls people like Disraeli and other big government conservative is the wrong way to put it. I mean, we're not talking about a kind of George Bush compassionate conservatism here. We're talking about a conservatism that cares for things other than the elites and maintaining aristocratic traditions and so on. It's a broader vision of what conservatism is, and we can come to how he explains that. But he says it's on page 135 of the version we're reading, Jonathan. He says, "The real American conservative assimilates into conservatism whatever he finds lasting and good in liberalism and in the New Deal." So these are the two headline things that I think are different about his conservatism to the kind of conservatism that you usually read about when you read people like Russell Kirk, who doesn't really talk about the New Deal at all, and doesn't talk about liberalism as a positive so much. Although he does talk about liberal thinkers as a positive influence on the conservative tradition, and maybe we can come back to whether there's not as much of a divide between Virick and Kirk as what Virick thinks there is. But if we think about liberalism and the New Deal as these headline things that are part of this new conservatism, I think that's a very interesting and curious statement, which would be interesting to explore further.
I think something really significant that we need to take note of around this adjective new, when Virick talks about a new conservatism, is that he's very much talking about the American context and arguing or pointing out, observing that a distinct form or a distinct conservative tradition has emerged in the US that sets it apart from Europe, where you have much older, more aristocratic, monarchical, nationalist types or streams, currents of conservatism. And so what he's pointing to is that not only a new conservatism in the US, but a kind of in the global context, perhaps a new type of conservative tradition because of the characteristics of American settlement and development, in which liberal ideas have been assimilated, to use his term, into more Burkean conservative ideas in the European tradition. And I think he's really bringing this to light, which is fascinating, Simon.
So I agree, and I think this is a valuable part of his thesis, and that is to say, just to kind of, I guess, to rephrase what you're saying, conservatism is to an extent relativistic, and it relies on putting down roots in a tradition that really exists. So he actually makes a critique very early on in his essay about someone he thinks someone like Russell Kirk, and he targets Kirk, I think, because he's a headline thinker in the conservative movement post World War II in the US. So he kind of picks on Kirk. I don't know. I have a feeling that he might have some personal animus toward Kirk. I could be wrong. There's some history there that I would be very interesting, I'm sure. Some people have probably written about it or know about it. But he targets Kirk, and he suggests that Kirk has this unhistorical appeal to history. He says that their traditionless worship of tradition is this sort of, it's this vacuous sense of conservatism. He says that instead conservatism should be genuinely rooted and genuinely historically minded. And I'm using some of his language here when I'm saying this. And it should conserve the roots of that are really there. And he says this is what Burke's doing. But he suggests that modern American conservatives post 1950, led by Kirk, are sort of doing live action role playing, I guess we might say, that they're claiming to be a part of a tradition that they're not. And instead, he says we should reorient, as conservatives should reorient themselves to the roots that really exist. And those roots include classical liberalism. And he makes a case for the New Deal being a conservative maneuver in terms of policy and government, which, again, we can come back to what his argument for that, which I think is actually quite interesting and ironically actually recalls an older kind of British conservatism. The point's a good one, and it does make me think about Australia, because the question that I often get asked when I tell people I'm a conservative is, well, what is an actually, particularly from people in Europe, when I'm in Europe and I say I'm a conservative, they say, well, what is an Australian conservative conserving? It's a good question, right? Because Australia's a young country, and I think there's a good argument to be made that Australian conservatives are aiming to conserve not only an Australian tradition and political culture, but also a British one, because we, our culture is a British political culture. Our institutions are essentially British political institutions. And so I make that case for why I'm an Australian conservative. But the question still remains, well, is there something actually that Virek's doing here that helps us see the relative nature of being a conservative and of being prepared to change and adjust to your context?
Yeah, the parallel with Australia is apposite, and I would like to say something about that. I think this critique, because the thing is, notwithstanding everything we've said so far, Simon, just to spell this out for listeners who may not have read, well, won't have read, let's face it, the essay, it's also a critique of the new conservatism.
Yeah, it is.
Hence the subtitle, What Went Wrong. And he uses the word defect. One of the defects of new conservatism is, quote, rootless nostalgia for roots. And I think there's some validity to Kirk. I've always, the criticism of Kirk, I've always thought about this, because what Kirk does, which is really interesting, and there's only some validity, is he creates an Anglo-American tradition of conservatism and puts a whole bunch of British and American thinkers together and says they form one coherent tradition of thought. What Virek is saying is actually this is a kind of rootless nostalgia, and that the actual American tradition is deeply influenced, or is deeply liberal. But what it is a conservative liberalism compared to perhaps liberalism in some other jurisdictions. And he says things, for instance, and I quote, a genuinely rooted, history-minded conservative conserves the roots that are really there. And then he says exactly as Burke did. The Burkean, quoting again, builds on the concrete existing historical base, not on a vacuum of abstract, wishful thinking. End quote. And I've always thought there is a tinge of romanticism to Kirk's historiography. And I do think he almost single-handedly created a conservative tradition where no one had noticed one before. That is this Anglo-American tradition, from Burke to Santayana, as the second edition expanded it originally from Burke to Elliot, but it takes in John Adams and other, you know, Calhoun and other American figures. And so I think in a way, it's a rival historiography here. And in a sense, I think there's some credit that goes to Viereck for being honest. And I think his honesty may have actually cost him, because what he's said is, okay, what is the actual empirical tradition in America?
Right.
It's not conservative in the European sense. Like, Burke is an influence, but it's not the conservative tradition that Kirk identifies, although to be fair to Kirk at the time he writes what was supposed to be called the conservative's route is this kind of lament at the liberal domination of America. And I think he's using liberal here in a sense that's a bit more like progressive. You know, he identifies it with collectivist thinking and the administrative state and so forth. And what he really wants to do is get America back to this conservative tradition. I think it's undeniable that liberalism, at least on the definition that Viereck's working with, has had a profound influence in America, which is why conservatism certainly rhetorically can be a little perplexing to those of us outside looking in, because it really does sound so libertarian at times, mixed with kind of more traditionalist conservatism. And I think Viereck, whether he's right or not, is at least looking at a sort of historical explanation for why this might be the case. And I think, as I've explored on other podcasts, liberalism is definitely a more dominant tradition in Australia than conservatism. I'm not actually sure you could add the conservative bit to a synthesis. In some ways, we're very much a product of 19th century liberalism. And I think conservatism has emerged here extremely late, and it's kind of struggling for its authenticity in a way, because it's only just starting to emerge organically and really in reaction to wokeism and, you know, the sexual revolution of the 60s and a whole bunch of phenomena and developments that post-date the context in which Viereck's writing.
John Howard was probably the first one to really articulate that there was a conservative part to the Liberal Party, I would have thought, whereas maybe before it was just assumed that the Liberal Party was more conservative, but they didn't need to say it. As time drags on, maybe people need to start using that language a bit more. But the point you make about rival historiographies is a really important one, because even if you read someone like Yoram Hazony, which we've both read with profit and have talked about on the podcast, and people can go and check that out, from about 12 months ago, the Hazony's historiography goes all the way back to medieval jurists. He goes back to Richard Hooker. And so he actually finds a conservative tradition that predates Burke. Russell Kirk actually wants to go back to Hooker right at the start of The Conservative Mind. Jonathan, you'll probably recall that he actually mentions Hooker very early on, and says, well, maybe we could start with Hooker, but we won't. We'll start with Burke. And so there's interesting that there's a similar genealogy that develops these thinkers. The question is, you're right, well, where do we start thinking about what conservatism is? It seems to me that Viereck is resistant to the idea that you could claim a tradition that extends beyond the geopolitical is probably the right word, actually. The geopolitical and geocultural boundaries of the polity that you're thinking and operating in. And so I think he is very hesitant to say that we can go beyond Burke, because Burke was writing and critiquing the French Revolution and speaking into the context in the American War for Independence, or the American Revolution, depending on how you want to frame that. At the same time, and the Burkean tradition can legitimately be seen, I think, in the American political milieu and political culture. You couldn't say that Richard Hooker is part of that. geopolitical and geocultural polity frame. But the question is, well, how do we draw the boundaries around this? And Virek doesn't want to extend it any further. Kirk's much more comfortable doing that. And he, you know, in the roots of American order, he goes all the way back to Athens and tries to find threads that link all of this together. Now,
that's right. He goes Athens, Jerusalem, London, and Washington. Yeah. That's the American tradition.
Yeah,
they right. come from those. They're the sources of influence.
And the question is, well, who's right? I mean, I don't know. I don't know who is right. I think it's legitimate to go further back than your geopolitical roots allow to find strands of thought and philosophy that help you think about what you're doing in your culture and in your politics, and that legitimately inform your particular context and your particular political milieu. Virek seems a little bit more hesitant to do that, but for good reason, because I think he wants to think, well, what is America and what constitutes American conservatism? What exactly are we conserving, practically speaking? Because I think I wonder, Jonathan, whether what's driving him is this resistance on the part of Kirkian types to the New Deal. I think Virek thinks the New Deal is a good thing. He thinks it's a legitimately conservative move. He even calls FDR a conservative, which would rile like a lot of people and rub them up the wrong way very much, because you know FDR is sort of almost a villain figure in the history of the American state, because he had expanded the administrative state so much, and Kirk gestures toward this in the conservative mind as a problem. But I mean, I think Virek at least helps us to kind of refocus ourselves on, okay, on this question, well, where do we draw these boundaries? And it did really give me pause. I thought it was helpful to ask that question.
Yeah, I think as well, something that's driving Virek's perspective is this emphasis on organic growth. And it comes out in a really, I thought, one of the most fascinating parts of the essay, which I hadn't heard before and I really like, and it's this contrast between, on the one hand, what he calls unity grown and unity made. And here he's making one of several powerful critiques of the left, noting again the time frame, you know, 30s and 40s. This is before the conservative movement. He was one of the earliest critiques of what the language of the day, critics of collectivism from the right, which ought to earn him a sort of place in the pantheon of conservative thinkers. But he makes this contrast, and I'm going to quote, between the left and the right. He says, leftist collectivists imposing their unity not as a rooted organic growth of shared values, but as a mechanical artifact of a priorist blueprint abstractions imposed gashingly upon concrete society by a Procrustean status bureaucracy. That's a hilarious kind of articulation.
Yeah, it is.
But there's this, I think one way of getting into the inner logic of Virek's critique of both certain conservatives, but also the left of his day, is that I think he really is an organicist. So he's very much into the organic growth of institutions and cultures, which does make you focus on the local and the particular. And so I think his gripe with the Kirkian-style conservatives is this romantic concoction, in his view, of a tradition that has never really existed in the US, and that they're not actually being honest about what the organic institutions and values are of the polity. And this is where, probably tendentiously, he, with contention, argues that the New Deal, I think, sits within the organic traditions and ethos of America. Whether he's right or not about the New Deal, I don't know. I don't really have a view and know enough about it. But I do think there is something to the critical observation about the conservative movement that emerges in the 50s. And we should just state for the record that although this essay was published in this collection in 1949, it was revised. And so there are references to the 1960s, and there's a whole interaction with Kirk in it that I assume has come later. So although it's published in 49, its final version is in the 60s, I gather. And again, it does, like you said, it gave you pause. It does make me think, okay, we could have a whole argument about organic versus more proactive. I don't think conservatives are locked into just organic growth, because I think culture can organically go into perverted and false mode, so that there is a role for proaction here. But it does get to that question of whether the conservative tradition is in some sense arbitrarily created in spite of the actual organic tradition that has emerged in a particular locality. And I think this is actually a pressing question for Australian conservatives, because I think the dominant tradition is liberal. And there is a sense in which this very late emergence of conservatism is a kind of rejection of the Australian tradition, which does go back a couple of centuries now.
Yeah, the argument that Virek makes about Kirk and the conservatives, post-World War II conservatives in America, could be made about Australian conservatives at the same time. So the question then becomes, well, what? It's a question of what resources you draw on in the end, isn't it? It's a question of, are the resources that exist beyond your own local and particular context legitimate for forming your political philosophy and informing your policy and political action? Yeah, and so you're quite right about, you know, the Australian conservative tradition doesn't necessarily exist, but if you were to poll the people who wrote helped frame the Australian Constitution, most of them would be considered conservatives today. I would have thought maybe even all of them, the constitutional framers.
Well, at least socially conservative.
Yeah, but even
socially conservative.
But even their liberalism would probably just fit into the Liberal Party today, generally speaking. So
well, I think this is kind of in the fine print of Virek, and you have to keep this in mind that the liberalism he's talking about is, and he's explicit, a relatively conservative form of liberalism. And I think that's one reason why the term conservative emerges so late in Australia, is that it wasn't really needed as a contrast.
That's right.
Earlier, because
that's right,
most liberals through that Menzies period, like, liberalism did mean socially, a kind of socially conservative view of the world that had respect for empire and history and and British traditions, British law. It was kind of unapologetic about settlement. And so it was, and you would have found a very strong, particularly Protestant Christian element with a kind of Calvinist undertone, or perhaps even a high Anglicanism that kind of harked back to an established church and the British monarchy, and it was thoroughly monarchist. Like, these liberals weren't Republicans back in the 40s and 50s. The Republican movement kind of comes from a different tradition in Australia. And I think what happened is, at some point, liberalism actually starts to become quite progressive.
Yes.
Forcing those more conservative liberals to differentiate, and they look over to America and they see this robust kind of conservative milieu, and I think they tap into the language of that. And I think Howard is the hinge point here, because he was, by all accounts, the first Australian Prime Minister to describe himself as conservative. I remember him on Q&A once describing himself as a, quote, Burkean conservative, excuse me. But he also identified the Liberal Party as, actually, I just realized now, a synthesis, because he said it's the heir of Millian liberalism and Burkean conservatism. And he seemed comfortable with the fact that there was a Millian liberalism in there. But even Mill's form of liberalism is kind of conservative in
I think so.
In some respects. It's not actually progressive, really.
No, that's right. And this is so Howard was, you could say Howard was the first Liberal Prime Minister who had to call himself, who had to describe himself as a conservative, because there was a need to. He was differentiating himself against something that needed to be, well, he needed to name what he was differentiating himself against, which was a progressivism, which didn't really, I mean, even into the 1970s, I mean, what was progressivism? I mean, it wasn't clear even then. Mm. So when Malcolm Fraser's the Prime Minister in the late 1970s, we're not talking about Gough Whitlam is not a frothing at the mouth social radical. I mean, he does make some significant legislative moves which we would see as precursors to the kinds of social progressivism that we see today, and there's no question about that. That's an important point. And but Fraser is not calling himself a conservative in response to Whitlam. But then you have Robert. I mean, if Robert Menzies isn't a conservative, then I don't know who is. But he never has to call himself that. He never has to use that phrase. It's just everyone knows who he is and what he stands for without using that word. So I think that's a really interesting point. I want to draw attention to a particular.
Simon, can I just say, make one?
Yeah.
Can I just say something really quickly to cap that off? Because we've just got to bear in mind that the Labor Party is pretty conservative.
Yeah.
Until relatively recently.
That's right.
It's not a progressive party through a lot of this era, and would have been in some respects just as socially conservative as liberals back in the 30s, exactly. 40s, 50s.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And what happens in the 50s is there's the anti-communist DLP split, which large part of the Roman Catholic wing of the Labor Party go off and do their own thing, and that really starts to shape the future of the left-wing major party in Australia. That's a whole other story.
Largely under the influence of the extremely conservative Santa Maria.
Yes, that's exactly right. Well, and that's
very
socially
conservative.
And that's a whole other story which you might get Ian Tregenza back on to talk about, because he's good on this stuff. but I want to draw attention to something that Virek says. Again, it's coming back to this distinction he makes between unity that is grown and unity that is made. He talks about the anti-cash nexus and the anti-rugged individualism of the Tory socialists. So we have a bit of a red Tory, blue Labor thing going on here. And I think that's worth keeping in mind if you want to think about it in terms of modern parlance. But the names that he lists when he talks about Tory socialists is fascinating. Because then he says, in the aristocratic Shaftesbury, Disraeli, FDR, Stevenson tradition. Now, I've never ever seen anyone else put FDR and Shaftesbury and Disraeli in a tradition together. But Virek is doing this, and he really thinks that this is its own thing, and he differentiates it with the anti-capitalism of Marxism, or the socialists. So he says, okay, there's an anti-cash and anti-rugged individualism, Tory socialism on the one hand, and there's an anti-capitalist Marxism on the other hand. And this is this anti-cash, anti-rugged individualism, Tory socialism is the thing I think that he's saying is the American New Deal conservatism. So we have to try and reckon with what he's doing here. It's quite different to a free market conservatism that the modern Republican Party tend to represent. And it's not even quite old school liberalism, even though he's banging on about classical liberalism. There's actually something more complicated that he's doing here, because he's actually saying that conservatism is, in a sense, more pro-welfare and pro-communitarian than we often think of it. And I think that's a real challenge to think through, but it's actually also enriching, because I think today conservatives have an opportunity to recapture some of this side of the policy argument.
Which is interesting in our context, Simon, because certainly officially, you rarely, if ever, hear of self-professed conservatives either in the political realm or in the intellectual realm, saying that we need to undo the welfare state or Medicare in Australia. Now, that may be for obvious tactical reasons, because there's a broad-based consensus of support for them. And I do know that Howard, once upon a time, I think was opposed to Medicare, if I'm not mistaken. I know Tony Abbott attempted to put a modest, what I thought was a modest price point on Medicare that I actually thought was a good idea, because I think, people overuse the GP, but that just was one of many things that wounded him politically. The reaction was like off the charts. So perhaps it's because there's nothing you can do. But then this is where Virek, I think, is quite provocative, because he's like, okay, well, isn't there a sense in which welfare and Medicare are now kind of baked into the Australian tradition?
That's right.
These are untouchable, sacred cows that no one really questions. And if anything, it's a kind of badge of honor to hear Americans talk about our socialist health system, where I meet so many people from all walks of life who praise Medicare because of their personal experience. You know, I had this and I went to the hospital and it didn't bankrupt me.
Yes.
Whatever.
Yeah. And this is
that's our New Deal version, isn't it?
It is. No, it
particularly
is.
Medicare, I think. It's like,
It is like a New Deal, but it's part of the British paternalist tradition, I think. Part of the kind of the Shaftesbury Disraeli thing that Virek's talking about. I think Australia is more naturally Shaftesbury Disraeli. British paternalism merges with liberalism and you get the Australian welfare state, which is just baked. It's just part of what Australia's like, and it has been from the beginning, from what I can tell. There's not a kind of anti-government intervention cult, there's not an anti-government intervention political culture where we're suspicious of the government. In fact, we, for better or for worse, we look to the government for help a lot of the time, and it's partly, I think, because of this paternalism that's baked in, which I think is what Virek's partly referring to when he's talking about this Tory socialism.
But, you know, just at the more universal level, you could argue that Virek, and I think you just raised this issue, there's also an arbitrariness, arguably, to the tradition he's painting.
Yeah.
And it just shows this, in a way, I think this is the challenge for conservatives. I think they know instinctively that tradition is important, and I definitely think it's far more important than people realize. I think humans are tradition-making animals. I don't think you can not have tradition, whether you're in a small tribe or a city of 20 million people. Could quibble about the distinction perhaps between habits, culture, tradition, but there are these modes of relating and behaving that always seem to emerge. Obviously, they're variable, so that you get very different traditions from Saudi Arabia to South Africa to, Vanuatu or whatever. But I think because conservatives put such a premium on tradition, then they're forced to kind of define what is intrinsically difficult to define. And actually, it's almost like trying to catch water. And so I've often thought with Kirk that his historiography is questionable, but that's kind of not the point. The point is that I do think we actually create traditions, and sometimes consciously, and that they're good because they provide frameworks for understanding the world and your place in it and your identity. And you think here the contrast with contemporary atomistic society, which you really see in the current identity politics, is it's the antithesis of tradition, in that each individual creates their own identity out of thin air and injects it into this absolute cacophony, a mess of identity. Whereas the conservatives, like, no, there are certain traditions that operate at a more macro level that bind us all and form and shape us. And I think that's right, but in a way, there's this vain attempt to justify them historically. And I'm not saying they're completely ahistorical, but you're never going to find the boundary. And the fact that, like, Kirk can casually say, well, I could go back to Hooker, but I'm going to start with Burke. He ends with Elliot in the first edition, then just magically expands it to Santayana.
Yes.
And critical readers of Burke have always quibbled about, you know, does this person fit into the constellation or not? But I don't think you can ever avoid that problem. But they're all, I think all these conservative thinkers are working from the sound instinct that you do need some tradition. You can't just be an untethered individual who creates their own gender, ideology, religion, spirituality, national identity or non-national identity. And it goes back to Burke's little platoons. You have to have some connection to your neighbors.
Correct.
If you're going to live in any society.
Correct.
Some shared values.
Yeah. I really appreciate that point, actually, that Even if Virek is right that Kirk's historiography is dicey, it sort of doesn't matter because he's trying to bed American political culture to something bigger than itself. Furthermore, I would say, just to build on what you're saying, in defense of Kirk, he is trying to, I think, connect modern liberal democracy to a higher moral order, which I think if you ask me, I think that's necessary for the continuation of something like liberal democracy, because otherwise it is purely relativistic. If you're a conservative, you're just as relativistic as your progressive colleague or friend or opponent. It's just that you just go slightly further back in your historical consciousness. This is not, and then you also get into the dangerous position of defending things that are indefensible, like female genital mutilation. Well, it's a tradition, and so we just, you know, we don't argue against female genital mutilation because it has a long history that's just one example. You could name any other sort of atrocities and things that are clearly morally against the moral order, the objective moral order. Kirk wants to ensure that conservatives are bedded in an objective moral order. He makes this one of the clear tenets of his conservatism up front. And I think his attempt to hook American conservatism to Jerusalem and Athens, and not just London. Because if you started in London, you could end up, you know, saying, well, that's fairly kind of relativistic. It's got roots, but where do you go once you move on from London? I mean, like, what if you want to leave London behind? What happens to your conservatism? That's the risk with the Viereks, with the Viereks of the world, perhaps. Whereas I think at least Kirk is trying to connect American civilization to something bigger than itself and something more objective than itself. That strikes me as something that I think is defensible as well.
I totally agree. I think I'll just add that Kirk was aware that the spiritual was an important political, cultural factor, and that is missing from Viereck. And I've got to say it's missing from the right in general these days, I find. It's become kind of spiritually bankrupt, and I do find an appeal in Kirk to that notion of an objective moral order, and politics just being one aspect of human life, but wrapped up into a much higher end of searching for some kind of harmony, connection with the divine. And I always find those big visions difficult to translate into politics, but I think you need them. Actually, Burke goes into this in Reflections on the Revolution in France, that one of the roles the church plays is to remind political leaders that there is a higher purpose for humanity beyond politics. And if without that, then you get stuck in the kind of pelf, I think is the weird term you use, of the moment. Things like egos, he doesn't use that term, but what he's really talking about is, you know, human nature has to be directed to something higher, even if it doesn't get there.
Yes.
Because otherwise we can actually degenerate. And I don't get any sense of that in Viereck. And it's because you don't get that from liberalism, because of liberalism's agnosticism, which I think actually is the key idea there. So in liberalism, the individual, the state, and all institutions, at least in theory, I mean, in practice, I'm not sure this is even possible, but in theory, they don't take stands on key moral questions. That's left to individuals and communities to sort out. And this really is at the heart of the libertarian vision of the world. And I think Kirk is like, well, that it's really traditionalist conservatism is actually, you know, and there's obviously a Christian element here that we're made for relationship with God, and without that, things can become perverted. So I think the influence of the liberal part of the liberal conservative synthesis in Viereck means that there's really no mention or even hint that the spiritual, the Christian, the divine has any relevance to the conversation at all. And I think that ultimately is where conservative liberalism takes you, which I'll take any day of the week over progressivism myself and socialism and some other isms, because I do think it has some virtues, because I think that Viereck style generally does respect freedoms.
Yes.
Which a lot of people don't these days, including a lot of conservatives, I have to say.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I would take Viereck over a lot of people in our major right-wing party today, to be honest, Jonathan. I don't think Viereck gets us where we need to go. But I think his critique is important, because I think toward the end of the essay, he zeroes in on some interesting and very, very particular events in the United States in the 50s and 60s, in particular McCarthyism and Senator Joseph McCarthy's pursuit of communists in America, and particularly in the upper echelons of American politics and the civil service, and the public service or whatever it's called in the United States. And he thinks that it's really interesting that he sees a turn to ideology here rather than this maintenance of anti-ideology that conservatism should, he thinks, represent. And he thinks it becomes right-wing radicalism and a more radical nationalism, and diverges from what conservatism should be. Now, this strikes me less as a philosophical problem and more as a prudential issue that didn't really go very well for someone like Kirk, maybe, and his alliance with Barry Goldwater. I don't have strong feelings about his alliance with Goldwater. I don't really know much about how it went, but Viereck seems to think that this really compromises a lot of the conservative leaders at this time. And this is something that's worth reflecting on, because there are things happening in the Anglophone world, particularly in the United States at the moment with Donald Trump and other populist figures, which may be comparable to some of the tendencies that that Viereck is pointing out here.
I actually thought of that exact comparison too, Simon.
Right.
Because I thought it's McCarthyism, but also the John Birch Society, which was a big controversial thing at the time, that eventually, but perhaps sluggishly, all the luminaries of the conservative movement eventually condemned and dissociated themselves from. National Review famously came out with, I think, Buckley in an editorial or article criticizing the John Birch Society. And I think this was the kind of Trump moment, or Trump test, you could say, in Viereck's day from his perspective. So in McCarthyism, he saw a form of totalitarianism that he was against. And I think subsequent historiography has borne that out, to be honest. I mean, I don't think there are a lot of fans of McCarthy on the right these days, because he kind of lost the plot a bit and ended a pretty tragic figure, as it happens. And I don't think the reputation of the John Birch Society has really recovered.
No.
And I think the right was right to condemn it. But I think Virek's complaint is that these were obvious moral tests and it should have been easy slam dunks for principled conservatives to never get in bed with these two figures. John Birch himself, I guess. It is John Birch, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thought maybe I got his first name wrong. And I get the strong sense Virek would have been outraged at the Trump moment, like some other conservative intellectuals, and he would have seen it as a test too, and he probably would have written an essay criticizing the new conservatives.
Published in the Atlantic, probably published in the Atlantic or something similar. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, he would have gone on CNN or something. But yeah. Or MSNBC. But The Dispatch, probably.
Look, yeah.
The Dispatch. Yeah, yeah. Or the Bulwark.
The Bulwark,
obviously,
yeah.
Obviously, you know, these are divisive questions and conservatives have different views on Trump. I mean, he's a polarizing figure. But I do have to say where I think Virek is right is that I do think periodically tests emerge for the right. And, I mean, he's thinking as someone who lived through the fascism in Europe, which was, so he was well, I think, more attuned to the risk of right-wing extremism than many conservative thinkers are on the right today. And they always, often forget that extremism is not just on the left. You can get it on the right too, and it can be a slippery slope. That is, people can unconsciously move into a kind of populism or nationalism, which are the two routes, I think, to some form of right-wing authoritarianism, whether it's fascism or not. That's a technical discussion that people gloss over these days. And I'm not saying that has necessarily happened with Trump, but I do think whether Trump goes over the line, I think he does open the door. And you can actually see that in the strange kind of things some so-called conservatives embrace that really are out of step with the tradition of conservative thought. And very little justification is given in an intellectual sense. Like, there's no effort to show how this actually comports with the tradition of conservative thought. It kind of seems like naked political expedience often.
Yeah, one of the things I was thinking as I was reading this was, what would I do if I was in America? It's easy for us to comment on this as Australians sitting, you know, like, sitting over here in Australia, like a bazillion miles away from anything that's going wrong in the world, basically, and comment on the United States. So any listeners in the United States should take what we say with all due respect. But I was thinking, what would I do if I was an American right now? Now, I mean, my disposition is to be sympathetic to those who are alarmed at the direction of the American polity on the right. And so, therefore, I think, well, maybe I would vote for Trump, you know, in 2024. You know, here I am outing myself a bit. But this made me think, it really is a complicated and dangerous situation where you have to weigh up your ideals. And this is, I guess, what people were facing in the 50s. They had to weigh up their ideals and their philosophical integrity with the practical art of politics. And the practical art of politics is actually not ideas, it is the implementation of policy and the toward the ends of politics, which can be many and varied depending on how you define it. But I think that one of the complicating factors here, Jonathan, is that in order to conserve some of the things that some of the people on the American right are saying is, in order to conserve the American way of life, we need to take drastic action. And that involves electing someone like Trump. And it's not even necessarily Trump. It could be someone like Trump to then, you know, drain the swamp and rid the American landscape of these elements that are destroying our country. So I read Virek and was like, as thinking this is a good warning. Again, it gives me pause around some of these issues. It doesn't answer the question as to what to do, but it is a good historical lesson, I think. And his critique is very interesting because I do think, supporting McCarthy is not really, I don't really see like pro-McCarthyism in what Kirk writes. But it's interesting that his actions played out more along those lines until eventually it became too much and they had to write a denunciation of the John Birch Society and critique McCarthy. So, yeah, they're my reflections on that issue.
I think what Virek is pointing to is that it's not, in his view, that courageous really late in the piece.
No, that's right. When Kirk did that.
But he's obviously... Yeah. Now, whether or not that's fair to Kirk, I don't know. But I can sharpen what I mean by this. I think it is a moral challenge or a particular challenge that comes up. This comes up for the left as well, by the way. And some people pass it, but many flunk it. And that is, in the heat of political contestation, you're often confronted with the choice of sacrificing principle for what you oppose, which often means getting into bed with people you know you don't actually like or agree with. You object to them on principle, but you say nothing or you work with them for the sake of what you oppose, that is trying to vanquish a threat, or do you suffer what you oppose for the sake of principle?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm in the camp of you suffer what you oppose for the sake of principle. But my reason is that if you win by sacrificing your principle, then it's not actually worth the victory because you vanquished your opponent. Maybe you find yourself in power, but you've made that compromise. I think it's very difficult to come back after you've compromised. And often you end up pretty much mirroring the pathologies of what you oppose. That's a real risk if you sacrifice principle. But then, because I am a Kirkian conservative, and Virek is on the same page here.
Yes.
Is that politics is really not the vocation of the conservative.
That's right.
Day-to-day politics is not what conservatism actually is about, which will sound strange to people. But both Kirk, the self-described man of letters, and Virek, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, they thought conservatism was first and foremost an intellectual tradition that had its biggest impact in culture.
That's right.
Including the arts.
Well, they both emphasized poetry, right?
Yeah, and Kirk wrote gothic novels.
That's right. Gothic ghost stories, they no all less. Were, yeah.
They were creative types too, which you don't get a lot of these days in on the conservative side of politics. So for some reason they've vacated the whole creative arts to the left.
But anyway, that
view, so just to repeat it, I think, and I'm not saying anyone who goes the other way is wrong. I think it's a dilemma, but you often have to make a wicked choice between sacrificing your principle for the sake of what you oppose or suffering what you oppose for the sake of principle.
Yeah, and I see in the online right world a lot of denunciations of conservatives because of this tendency to say, well, I don't want to sacrifice my principles. And that, you know, the argument is, well, what's the point of conservatism if it's not going to, you know, win the battle? You know, the friend-enemy, they call them the friend-enemy distinction. And they say, well, you have to win battles against your enemies.
That's my point.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, I know it is.
If the cost of winning is sacrificing your principle, then is it actually...
Yeah,
you could win and cease, and what actually wins is not actually conservatism.
That's right, and so that's the real dilemma that I think people in the United States are facing. Thankfully, in Australia, we're not facing that dilemma. It's a much more cooperative political culture, but you know the tendencies could come out and do come out every so often. So I think Virek's warning is a good one and worth bearing in mind for conservatives as a perennial. Issue to sort of keep in the forefronts of our minds as we think politically, but I think the point about culture is a really important one, that conservatism is a cultural project more so than a political project. And conservatives will often compromise their principles once they enter into the political realm. And that's an unfortunate byproduct of that. I don't know whether that can be avoided, but it is an interesting dilemma as well around the politics versus culture issue.
And I stress this happens on the left just as much as the right, this choice between compromising your principles for what you oppose versus suffering what you oppose for your principles. There is one final issue I'd like to get to, which is this notion of stereotypes and archetypes, which does tie back into this organic growth versus, I guess you could say, manufactured culture. And I thought this was quite a penetrating insight from Viereck, and clearly his whole critique of the new right is debatable. Some conservatives are going to like it, some are going to recoil, but he does have some really incisive criticisms, I think, of the culture that are still really pertinent today. And I just want to read out a couple of quotes that I thought were really delicious. He says, "For thoughtful conservatives today, the meaningful moral choice is not between conforming and non-conforming, but between conforming to the ephemeral stereotype values of the moment and conforming to the ancient, lasting, archetypal values shared by all creative cultures." Yeah. And then he goes on, "Archetypes have grown out of the soil of history, slowly, painfully, organically. Stereotypes have been manufactured out of the mechanical processes of mass production, quickly, painlessly, artificially." And then final quote, "Every stereotyped society swallows up the diversities of private bailiwicks, private eccentricities, private inner life, in creativity inherent in concrete personal loyalties and in loving attachments to unique local roots and their rich historical accretions." Here again, you can get a sense of why I really describe him as an organicist type conservative. But can I just note one really interesting thing here, which you get in older forms of conservatism, the old new conservatism, if that makes sense to put it in Viereck's languages. And it's quite fascinating because diversity is all the rage today. And superficially, we live in extremely diverse cultures, particularly in places like Australia, with multiculturalism, it's multi faith, and there's lots of different expressions of humanity and a lot of freedom to express yourself and embrace whatever identity you want. He in an earlier era, as a man of the early 20th century, I think he's reacting to what he sees as the stifling effects of the post-industrial revolution, the kind of standardization, the mass manufacture and mass marketing and mass production of products that has kind of crushed the small artisan and cottage industry. And that's a kind of conservative tradition that does go back to the UK and the whole, you know, I guess the Luddites and others. And I thought it's interesting because he might say to us, including conservatives today, that look, you're obsessed with, say, sexual diversity and the implications of that, but what about the crushing conformity of neoliberal economics and the just the way that your habits and cultural attitudes are shaped by Hollywood and by capitalism and this? And I think it's kind of interesting, an interesting insight that we've perhaps is a bit obscured by our individualistic focus on diversity in terms of skin color, sexual organs, orientations. And maybe, here we go, here's a thought, Simon. Maybe that phenomenon of extreme diversity in what some have called expressive individualism is a consequence of the stifling conformity of our economic exchange habits and our work habits and our those things that really shape who we are.
I loved this part of Viereck's essay because it resonated with me philosophically and just at an intuitive level. I thought, yes, he is he's identifying something crucial here. Now, organicism as a philosophical framework has its problems, but it's a rich way of understanding culture and nations and the role of culture and the arts in society, which is where he goes with this eventually. Your point is great, I think, about the impact of economics and of capitalism and of neoliberal settlement that we've all been living through since the 1970s, 1980s maybe. There have been other thinkers, that have identified the connection between that economic settlement and the kinds of social chaos, for want of a better term, that we're observing today. That these two things are deeply connected. And conservatives should be much more concerned with the destruction and disorder that is caused by things like industrial uniformity and the crushing of individual small enterprise, family businesses, the way that local customs and traditions are annihilated by international mega corporations. And so I think this is a really rich vein of thought that needs to be drawn out more on the right by conservative. I think conservatives are better placed to do it than a lot of other people on the right, because conservatives have a love of local places, traditions, and practices, and they inherently understand the value of the little platoon that Burke calls it, which is really the family as the starting point, and building from there to local communities and other layers of allegiance and connection to your place. This is a really rich vein, and I really appreciated this part of the essay. And that distinction, which we haven't really gone into, between the archetype and the stereotype is crucial. The way you've explained it's adequate, I think. But I really liked this move that he makes with those different values, the archetypal values, which are organic and they grow from a natural basis, and they go up through local communities, they go up through in expressions of culture, and they finally come to fruition in politics, ultimately, I think, is where he would go with that. But the stereotype is this sort of uniform, conformist, top-down approach to these issues, which I think is not where conservatives want things to be. So it was a helpful point that he makes there.
And I thought that was the most original part of his essay. I haven't come across this elsewhere, but maybe he did get it from someone else. But I really was struck by this notion that archetypes emerge, quote, painfully.
Yeah.
And stereotypes emerge painlessly. And that's probably linked to just the slow, organic growth of them. And I like the idea of the stereotype being a kind of shallow ersatz version of the archetype. And what the human really needs is to be governed by the archetypes, which are timeless, and what Burke, through Eliot, would have called the permanent things. And it's when Virek's talking like this, you really see this is quintessentially conservative thinking, and he's well and truly right in the heart of the kind of Kirkian traditionalist conservative world, and he really starts to sound like it. Again, there's no hint here of a religious dimension, but it's not certainly not incompatible. And maybe I don't know if he was a religious person of any sort, but I really, really love this stereotype versus archetype thing. I also thought of Jordan Peterson, the whole archetype thing.
Yeah.
I think in a funny way, his Virek kind of decades ahead of Peterson in seeing the importance of archetypes, although Peterson's probably thinking of that more in a specifically kind of psychological sense. But again, it's this recognition, and this really is where this is the dividing wall between conservatism and all other isms, is the idea, the very notion of an archetype, a permanent thing, a universal, notwithstanding all of the local platoony particularity we've been talking about. There is overarching this idea that there is some kind of permanent thing that all humans crave or need, which is why conservatism lends itself so nicely to Christianity. And there's that whole thinking of whether conservatism can retain its integrity without Christianity. That's for another show. But again, I one reason why I'm so attracted to conservatism is that in my second-to-second consumerist, extreme individualist cultural water that I'm forced to swim in, it's just nice to be forced to think about something beyond that, that is transcendent, permanent, archetypal. And I find I crave that kind of thing. Now, they all raise philosophical problems because they're all metaphysical, really. Mm-hmm. But I think we need that metaphysic, that realm beyond what we can see and touch and analyze and assess in, empirically. And it's really what's not only what's missing, I find, in all the other isms, and it's missing in a lot of conservatives these days, to be frank. But when you lose that, bad things can happen because you, as we, when we talk about Voegelin, you immanentize the eschaton.
That's right. That's
salvation
right.
Salvation becomes imminent and material. And that motivates people to kill and to do radical things in the name of progress or justice or salvation. There's a kind of, paradoxically, there's a humility in these big transcendent visions because they say to you, you're not just a self-defining individual who can be whatever you want. You're plugged into a universe that is kind of set, has some kind of fixtures in it. And if you orient yourself to some of these lighthouses, just to mix my metaphors all over the place, then it can be, it can lead to flourishing.
Exactly. And this, I think this aspect of Virek's essay also shows that he's not really very far outside the tradition that he's arguing against, actually. He does oppose himself to it. It's interesting that he seems like he was a bit politically homeless or ideologically homeless. He was probably disliked on the left and the right. But his intuitions seem to me to be mostly conservative. I mean, regardless of what you think about the New Deal, his argument for the New Deal is a conservative argument. It's not a progressive argument. You know, it's not like, hooray for big government and for the power of the state. It's actually an argument that is based upon this. It's based upon the fact that communities matter and that the little people matter and that the spiritual life of places matters. I don't mean spiritual in the sense of church and God. I just mean that there's more going on with people than simply economic exchange. And again, this comes back to that kind of Tory socialist vibe that he's giving off and that he's also explicitly articulating. It seems to me like Virek's, his beef with our friend Russell Kirk and, you know, William F. Buckley and other people, I wonder, it's more particular to the time and place that they were, to the public discourse and the debates that were happening at the time, and if they were around together today, it might be a very different story. They might not be so opposed to one another. But that's neither here nor there. In one sense, I think the fact that he's able to look in on the movement that you and I appreciate, Jonathan, and offer a rich and interesting critique is valuable for conservatives and for others who aren't conservative as well to consider too.
And he certainly has a place cemented in the pantheon and historiography of the right in America. If anyone reads any of the great works of history there, he's certainly well known, even if he's not well read these days. And like all these figures, a profitable read, and we encourage all those who think they're conservatives or are conservatives, those youngsters, to actually read into the tradition so that we can be intellectually equipped, because we have to keep the tradition alive and critically engage and interact with it. Otherwise, we do just become nationalists or populists or authoritarians or something bad like that.
That's right.
Even though that's probably half the listeners.
Well, there's nothing evil about being a nationalist, but you know, we know what you mean. I think that becomes everything. You become unhinged.
Well, it's a whole other.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the notion of patriotism, which is a kind of dying concept more than nationalism myself. Sure. But that's a distinction begging for a whole podcast.
Yeah,
and we can't open that
that
cat of worms. So, Simon, look, we could keep going, but I think we'll with that kind of petering out, should bring the conversation to an end.
Yeah.
So thanks so much for coming on and having another ripping conversation about a conservative thinker.
That's been very good, and I look forward to the next one. Thanks, Jonathan.
Well, folks, if you enjoyed the show, consider giving it a 5-star on Apple and or Spotify. Subscribe if you haven't, and I'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.